Good morning, this is Krishna McKenzie with your road back to nature, a cultural redemption, trying to rediscover our relationship with Mother Nature in relation to where our food comes from as the very foundation of any community, any society has to have an access to food, to local food, for its physical well-being. And then everything follows from there. So this week I thought I'll share with you again a bit more from The One Straw Revolution, this book that's written by my inspiration, Masanobu Fukuoka. And I will, I have a couple of chapters to read to you at the end, which are quite interesting. So I thought I'll read you those. So this is called The Theory of Relativity. Looking out into the bright sunlight of the autumn sky, scanning the surrounding fields, I was amazed. In every field but mine, there was a rice harvesting machine or combine running around. In the last 3 years, this village has changed beyond recognition. As one might expect, the youths on the mountain do not envy the changeover to mechanization. They enjoy the quiet, peaceful harvest with the old hand sickle. That night, we were finishing the evening meal. I recalled over tea how long ago in this village, in the days when the farmers were turning the fields by hand, one man began to use a cow. He was very proud of the ease and speed with which he could finish the laborious job of ploughing. 20 years ago, when the first mechanical cultivator made its appearance, the villagers all got together and debated seriously which was better, the cow or the machine. In 2 or 3 years, it became clear that ploughing by machine was faster, and without looking beyond considerations of time and convenience, the farmers abandoned their draft animals. The inducement was simply to finish the job more quickly than the farmer in the next field. The farmer does not realize that he has merely become a factor in modern agriculture's equation of increasing speed and efficiency. He lets the farm equipment salesman do all the figuring for him. Originally, people would look into a starry night sky and feel awe at the vastness of the universe. Now questions of time and space are left entirely to the consideration of scientists. It is said that Einstein was given the Nobel Prize in Physics in deference to the incomprehensibility of his theory of relativity. If his theory had explained clearly the phenomena of relativity in the world and thus release humanity from the confines of time and space, bringing about a more pleasant and peaceful world, it would have been commendable. His explanation is bewildering, however, and it caused people to think that the world is complex beyond all possible understanding. A citation for disturbing the peace of the human spirit should have been awarded instead. In nature, the world of relativity does not exist. The idea of relative phenomena is a structure given to experience by the human intellect. Other animals live in a world of undivided reality. To the extent that one lives in the relative world of the intellect, one loses sight of time that is beyond time and of space that is beyond space. You might be wondering why I have this habit of picking on the scientists all the time, I said, pausing to take a sip of tea. The youth looked up smiling, faces glowing and flickering in the firelight. It is because the role of the scientist in society is analogous to the role of discrimination in your own minds. A village without war and peace. page 172. A snake seizes a frog in its mouth and slips away into the grass. A girl screams. A brave lad bears his feelings of loathing and flings a rock at the snake. The others laugh. I turn to the boy who threw the stone. What do you think that is going to accomplish? The hawk hunts a snake. The wolf attacks the hawk. A human kills the wolf and later succumbs to a tuberculosis virus. Bacterias breed in the remains of the human, and other animals, grasses and trees thrive on the nutrients made available by the bacteria's activities. Insects attack the trees. The frogs eat the insects. Animals, plants, microorganisms, all are part of the cycle of life, maintaining a suitable balance. They live a naturally regulated existence. People may choose to view this world either as a model of strong consuming weak or of coexistence and mutual benefit. Either way, it is an arbitrary interpretation which causes wind and waves, brings about disorder and confusion. Adults think the frog is deserving of pity and feeling compassion for its death, despise the snake. This feeling may seem to be natural, just a matter of course, but is this what it really is? One youth said, if life is seen as a contrast, a contest in which the strong consume the weak, the face of the earth becomes a hell of carnage and destruction, but it is unavoidable that the weak should be sacrificed so that the strong may live. That the strong win and survive and the weak die out is a rule of nature. After the passage of millions of years, the creatures now living on the earth have been victorious in the struggle for life. You could say that the survival of the fittest is a providence of nature, said a second youth. That's how it appears to you, the winners. Anyway, the way I see it, this world is one of coexistence and mutual benefit. At the foot of the grain is the field, clover, and so many varieties of grasses and weeds are living mutually beneficial lives. Ivy winds around the trees, moss and lichen live it. Attached to the tree's trunk and branches, ferns spread out beneath the forest canopy. Birds and frogs, plants, insects, small animals, bacteria, fungi, all creatures perform essential roles and benefit from one another's existence. A third spoke. The earth is a world of the strong consuming the weak, and also one of coexistence. The stronger creatures take no more food than necessary. Though they attack other creatures, the overall balance of nature is maintained. The providence of nature is an ironclad rule, preserving peace and order upon the earth. Three people and three points of view. I met all three opinions with a flat denial. The world itself never asks whether it is based upon a principle of competition or of cooperation. When seen from the relative perspective of the human intellect, there are those who are strong and there are those who are weak. There is large and there is small. Now, there is no one who doubts that this relative outlook exists, but if we were to suppose that the relativity of human perception is mistaken, for example, that there is no big and no small, no up or down, if we say that there is no such standpoint at all, human values and judgment would collapse. Isn't that way of seeing the world an empty flight of the imagination? In reality, there are large countries and small countries. If there is poverty and plenty, strong and weak, inevitably there will be disputes and consequently winners and losers. Couldn't you say rather that there that these relative perceptions and the resulting emotions are human and therefore natural, and that they are a unique privilege of human being human. Other animals fight, but do not make war. If you say that making war, which depends upon ideas of strong and weak, is humanity's special privilege, then life is a farce. Not knowing this farce to be a farce, there lies the human tragedy. The ones who live peacefully in a world of no contradictions and no distinctions are infants. They perceive light and dark, strong and weak, but make no judgments. Even though the snake and the frog exists, the child has no understanding of strong and weak. The joy, the original joy of life is there, but the fear of death is yet to appear. The love and hate which arise in the adult's eyes originally were not two separate things. They are the same thing as seen from the front and from the back. Love gives substance to hate. If you turn the coin of love over, it becomes hate. Only by penetrating to an absolute world of no aspects is it possible to avoid becoming lost in the duality of the phenomenal world. People distinguish between self and other. To the extent that the ego exists, to the extent that there is another, people will not be relieved from love and hatred. The heart that loves the wicked ego creates the hated enemy. For humans, the first and greatest enemy is the self that they hold so dear. People choose to attack or to defend. In the ensuing struggle, they accuse one another of instigating conflict. It is like clapping your hands and then arguing about which is making the sound, the right hand or the left. In all contentions, there is neither right nor wrong, neither good nor bad. All conscious distinctions arise at the same time, and all are mistaken. To build a fortress is wrong from the start. Even though he gives the excuse that it is for the city's defense, the castle is the outcome of the ruling lord's personality and exerts a coercive force on the surrounding area. Saying he is afraid of attack and that fortification is for the town's protection, the bully stocks up weapons and puts the key in the door. The act of defense is already an attack. Weapons for self-defense always give a pretext to those who instigate wars. The calamity of war comes from the strengthening and magnifying of empty distinctions of self, other, strong, weak, attack, defense. There is no other road to peace than for all people to depart from the castle gate of relative perception, go down into the meadow, and return to the heart of non-active nature. That is sharpening the sickle instead of the sword. The farmers of long ago were a peaceful people, but now they are arguing with Australia about meat, quarreling with Russia over fish, and dependent on America for wheat and soybeans. I feel as if we in Japan are living in the shadow of a big tree, and that there is no place more dangerous to be during a thunderstorm than under a big tree. And there could be nothing more foolish than taking shelter under a nuclear umbrella, which will be the first target in the next war. Now we are tilling the earth beneath that dark umbrella. I feel as though a crisis is approaching from both inside and out. Get rid of the aspects of inside and outside. Farmers everywhere in the world are at root the same farmers. Let us say that the key to peace lies close to the earth. So that is there's one last chapter here in the book, which you can read another time. It's very intense philosophy of non-duality, and some people may think, you know, well, hang on, we're trying to promote organic farming in Oroville and get people to realize where their food comes from. What's all this non-duality about? Where does this fit in? What Fukuoka really, as far as I understand, is trying to point out is that nature is always there. She's non-moving. She's, you know, without ideas, without concepts, without economy, without judgment. And it's, she is the arms of Mother Nature, you know. She is the Devi, the goddess, wanting to, you know, not even wanting to, just offering abundance and well-being and beauty. And as long as we have an idea in our mind, in any which way, we will move away from that beauty and that abundance and the very foundation of health and wellness on our planet and within, on us and within our community and with our society. So I think what Fukuoka is really pointing out is that it's the way that thought operates that is at the root of us losing our relationship with Mother Nature, conceptual thinking, ideas, opinions, beliefs. And that it's when we can let go of these, you know, this very divisive, well, thought in essence is it divides, because when it defines one thing, it negates another. You know, this is good, well, then obviously this is bad. You know, we're defending, therefore, on the other hand, we're attacking. You know, this is big and then this is small. Whereas in nature, as he points out in this reading, you know, nature is really not like that. So I think that when we really try and explore our relationship with nature, especially with growing plants and harvesting and coming together and creating gardens collectively and enjoying the produce from those gardens and eating together and being with nature, especially, I think that these this philosophy of non-duality sort of shows itself to us. And brings a lot of brings the possibility of well-being into our lives. So anyway, read it yourself. It's much better. The One Straw Revolution, Masanobu Fukuoka. It's available in the Freeland Bookshop. It's available online. It's available, I think, in the something seagull, the wild seagull, or that bookshop that's by the Vista Center, and you can read more yourself. There, the nursery project happening in Alok's place, which is in Oroshilpam, opposite discipline, is going quite well, and there are a lot of tomato plants, a lot of eggplants, some basil starting now. Next will be capsicum. And lettuce, and people should come and get those plants. Come and take a tray of tomatoes and plant it out in your garden. That'll be a good use of those plants. So I look forward to speaking to you next week. You take care. Have a lovely week. And there's going to be heavy rains most of the week, but after these rains, we're going to start planting like crazy. Okay, thank you very much. Have a lovely day.
நீ பேசும் நேரத்தில் கல் கண்டு கசக்கும் உன்னிட கண்ட கேட்டுக்கொண்டிருப்பது ஆரோவில் ரேடியோ.